think there is extraordinary power in just starting, in just doing something, in getting your shovel dirty, right?
Yes.
Getting some dirt on that shovel.
Exactly.
There's real power in that. And the alternative to planning, strategizing, and thinking,
yep.
None of those tasks will create momentum.
Yeah.
And none of those tasks will create progress. Now, I confess, they can have the potential to help you to execute better. And so I don't want to discourage those tasks completely.
Yes.
But there is nothing like getting that spade dirty to actually create progress and momentum toward an ultimate big success.
You are listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
Well, I'm absolutely delighted today to be joined by Devin Thorpe. Devin, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be with you. I appreciated your joining me on my show a couple of years ago. And as they say, turnabout is fair play. And I love what you're doing. I love your new show. I think it's tremendous. And I'm so glad that you're out there doing this, because we need more cogent, thoughtful voices out there helping entrepreneurs to be successful.
Well, it's very kind of you. And I can tell you, I have three lines of just distilled bio here that says it all. So, Devin, you're a journalist, you're a Forbes contributor, you're an author of 5 books, you're a speaker, you're a champion of social good, you travel the world as a speaker, and I think your message is that you help the helpers, and you've devoted yourself to writing about, advocating for, and advising those that do good, which is just an astonishing mission. And your background is big company stuff. You were the CFO of a huge, you know, multinational F&B company. And I think there was a life change, something happened, and you, rather than saying, you know, I'm going to take a few weeks off, you know, spend some time with my kids or whatever, then go back. At that point, you decided, I think your expression is, I'm going to live the life that I didn't dare to dream.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it was an interesting experience for me, but I had long had this vision of myself leaping into a second career that would be focused on service. And so when I got fired from that job, you know, about 6 years ago, I said, I guess now's the time. And I started off with a year in China. That really was a wonderful experience to give me a chance to step back, clear my head, wrote a book, and launched into this new life and career. It was very poorly formed as a concept as I walked out the door.
Wonderful.
And great. We're still forming 6 years later, but we've made a lot of progress.
And I think that's the main thing. I think it's that ability just to say, I'm going to do it. I'm going to start. Because I think that is the thing that really propels people into successful careers, is the ability to take decisions. And that's, do you think that's something that you found with all of the hundreds of people that you've interviewed over the last few years?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it just absolutely, we see that over and over, entrepreneurs have to have a good balance of commitment to a vision, persistence, and an ability to pivot and adjust to the circumstances. And the very best entrepreneurs, I think, stay committed to a vision and a purpose, but are really pretty flexible about the tactics and even some of the strategies.
Exactly. I completely agree. And I want to come back on that point, because there's the bedrock is strategy, Oh, no. So the bedrock is vision. That's the thing that is that remains. That is the sort of the cornerstone. Then you have the strategy, I guess. Then you have the tactics. But I want to come back and talk about that because that's very interesting. But one of the other questions that I wanted to ask you was, if you had stayed as a CFO, do you think today, 6-7 years later, you would still be there? Or do you think you would have made the move anyway?
Well, it's a tough decision. And quite honestly, I think it would have been very tempting for me to stay there until something better came along.
Yes.
And I might not be doing what I'm doing now. And that there's some irony there, right? Because
yes.
I love what I'm doing.
Absolutely.
And I feel like I'm making such a better, bigger difference.
Yes.
In the world with what I'm doing now than what I was doing, that it's pretty remarkable. So, yeah, I it is interesting. I probably would not have had the courage to leave.
Yes.
I have to admit.
And if you sort of relate that, because there are people that are in the same position as you were with that sort of gnawing thought in the back of their mind, thinking, this isn't what I should be doing. With that sort of you had that sort of, you were pushed rather than jumped, as it were. But I'm sure you would have jumped anyway. But is there something that you really, do you know what I mean? What would you say to people that are in that sort of position?
Yeah, I think they're one of the key things to remember about entrepreneurship is that in the short run, it will not pay like that great corporate job you've had.
Yeah.
I was very fortunate to be making a nice high six-figure salary. I was, flying around on private jets, not always, but often traveling business class around the world. I mean, it was a pretty good gig. And in my new career, I travel all around the world, and it's at the back of the plane. I stay in cheap hotels and Airbnb situations. I rarely take my wife because she won't stay where I stay, won't go where I go. And now not every entrepreneur or social entrepreneur has to make all the sacrifices I've had. I'm not saying that's inherent, but it is rare that a senior executive can leave a big salary, big bonus, big stock option incentives, leave all that and make as much money in entrepreneurship in the short run. In the long run, a lot of entrepreneurs figure out a way, often by selling their business, to pocket much more than they would have with a career in, the career they had or might otherwise have had. But it is tough to step away. And so I think that the key thing is to make sure that you are ready emotionally and financially for that.
Yeah, and I agree. But the difference is you're actually talking about two different worlds. So I don't think you can compare the corporate world to your world right now. Would that be fair? You're not living the same 9-to-5 existence.
No. There is almost nothing the same in my world. It's amazing how little overlap there is in what I do in 2017 with what I was doing in, say, 2010.
And I think also the fear is, it's not a fear, but you're right. The reality is when you start as an entrepreneur, you're effectively starting a business, and businesses take years to grow. So there are all these issues associated with, instant gratification and, wanting everything to happen now. So it takes time and experience to get over that and to understand that it takes time. But I think the real value of what you've done is being able to compare side by side two existences, one where you're working for someone else, but you're very successful and you're achieving what you want to achieve. But I think the freedom and the reason I'm banging on about this is that I just think there is so much value in freedom and the ability to express yourself and not be constrained by other people's timescales that actually it's the money side of it almost becomes irrelevant because And I will finish shortly. The point is that you're making money so that you can have time off and go on fantastic holidays. But if actually you're completely in control of your time, then you can do whatever you want. So you don't need to earn as much. So
yeah. My work is my passion. And so I don't need as much break from it. When I travel internationally, I have just wonderful, profound experiences that are in many ways akin to vacation. But, yes. I'm actually out working productively, doing interesting things. I recently went to Africa and just submitted a story to the New York Times about what I learned there. And
yes.
So it really dovetails nicely work and passion.
Yes.
And so, I don't feel nearly the compulsion to have a vacation from that.
And that's also leads into my question about the difference between, you actually mentioned it yourself. You said entrepreneur, and then you corrected yourself by saying social entrepreneur. Do you think they are two different species, or do you think they should be the same?
Well, it's interesting that you ask. A lot of us in the impact community look down our noses at regular or traditional entrepreneurs, but I've known a lot of entrepreneurs over my lifetime, and I've never met a good entrepreneur who didn't want to make the world a better place.
Yes.
And I look at Steve Jobs as an example. Absolutely. Of that mentality. Steve Jobs was certainly not a social entrepreneur.
Yeah.
But he definitely wanted to make the world a better place. He wanted technology to help people, to make people's lives better. And he did that. And his legacy at Apple is an incredible legacy.
Yeah.
So I don't think that we should look down on entrepreneurs who are not social entrepreneurs. That said, I do think that there is a special role for entrepreneurs who really look at the world's biggest, most challenging problems and seek to solve those as a priority over making money in the world. And my hat's off to them.
But that's an outlook question. That's all about mindset. So forgive me for keep coming back to this. Mm-hmm. So the things you used to think about when you were CFO of this big global corporation, is that different to the things that you think about today?
Yes, dramatically so. Dramatically.
And your outlook, in other words, your view of what you think is possible, has that expanded because of the people that you've met?
Yes, it's interesting, and I hadn't thought about it in these terms before, but my worldview at running or helping to run this large corporation that had operations around the globe was small.
Yes.
I was focused on making profits, hitting margins, et cetera, very inward focused. Now in my new role, I find myself working on a tiny budget from my home office, and yet I am constantly thinking about the world's biggest issues, the biggest questions. I worry about America's democracy. I spend a lot of time thinking about that. I worry about girls not getting the opportunity to get a proper education,
yeah,
have proper opportunities in their lives because they are don't have access to sanitary pads.
Yes.
I mean, that thought had never occurred to me 10 years ago. And now that I find myself thinking about that all the time.
Yes.
And how do we address that issue? And there are in the world something like 20 million people right now who are at dire, imminent risk of starvation.
Yes.
Because of famines in Yemen, Sudan, and Somalia. And
yes,
this is scary stuff. And now I'm in a place where I'm feeling that as an acute personal problem in the same way I used to worry about margins at my old company.
Yes. And I think it's funny as well, because a lot of the successful entrepreneurs or business people that I've spoken to, they all have gone through that phase, or most of them have gone through the phase of chasing the dollar, and have realized that it's actually pretty pointless because there's only so much they can spend, and they can have 10 Ferraris and it doesn't actually feed the soul. But So your world is almost sort of completely sort of spun around on its axis, where the value now is actually in things that matter. And coming back to some advice to someone who's embarking on that course, I would imagine people are probably quite afraid to start out as a social entrepreneur because it just seems like it's a mountain. And many people that you've interviewed appear to be accidental entrepreneurs. And is there a learning? I mean, bearing in mind that you're now seeing the world as it is, which is much more enriching than seeing it through the other end of the telescope, as it were. Is there advice that you would give someone starting out who feels a calling towards social entrepreneurship?
Yeah, I think there is extraordinary power in just starting, in just doing something, in getting your shovel dirty, right?
Yes.
Getting some dirt on that shovel.
Exactly.
There's real power in that. And the alternative to planning and strategizing and thinking,
yeah,
none of those tasks will create momentum.
Yeah.
And none of those tasks will create progress. Now, I confess, they can have the potential to help you to execute better. And so I don't want to discourage those tasks completely.
Yes.
But there is nothing like getting that spade dirty to actually create progress and momentum toward an ultimate big success.
So let's come back to what you were saying earlier about these sort of three key elements, you know, the vision being the cornerstone. And that remains constant. This calling, this sort of drive, this determination, that doesn't go away. What changes, I think, and pivots and alters course is the execution of that. So with the people that you've spoken to, have you found, is it common that people try something, it fails, they bounce back, they try something else? So the execution layer sort of moves around a bit, but the vision stays the same.
I think there are two models that I've seen that are successful. One is the, you know, stay the course, fix the process model, right?
Yeah.
So they stay very aligned with an initial vision for what they will do. The strategy remains fairly constant, but at every level, they're reworking the tactics.
Yeah.
Okay, that didn't work as well. That way of doing it is too expensive. Let's figure out a way of trimming the cost out or accelerating that process, the timelines. And so they're working on just constant incremental improvements. And I see those people over long periods of time creating incredible successes. I'll give you one example. There's a fellow that started working on creating an association of smallholder farmers, of coffee farmers in Uganda.
Okay.
And he started, golly, nearly 20 years ago. He was raised by poor coffee farmers, and he saw how they got abused by the supply chains. And over 20 years,
yeah,
he has now aggregated an association of on the order of 1 million smallholder farmers in Uganda.
Wow.
And they have created a co-op, actually a collection of co-ops that now own all of the factory equipment for the entire supply chain.
Okay.
So these smallholder farmers can now sell some of their crop as finished coffee in a coffee shop.
Because they're in control of the supply chain now.
Right, so at $3 a cup.
Yes.
Instead of selling the raw
10 cents a ton or something, yes.
Yeah, at 10 cents yes. a ton. So, I mean, it's literally, on average, it's doubled the income of 1 million people in Uganda.
And again, but the central thread here is, if that guy 20 years ago said to all of his friends, do you know what, I've got this idea. I think what we need to do is take control of the supply chain, create a product and go straight to retail. Presumably, they're all going to be saying, you know, you're absolutely crazy. You would never be able to do that.
Right. Where will you get the money? How will all of us poor people get the money to do that?
We're just poor people. That's not the sort of thing that we do.
Right.
Get back in your box.
Yeah.
And I think that, again, this this idea of vision and the ability to see things is something that changes. I think it's, in my case, the older I get, the more, you know, things I've experienced, so the more I can see is possible, which is really irritating, because if I'd have had that sort of 20 years ago, then, you know, I would have been in a different place. But this whole concept, which I think you've experienced for yourself, is that there is nothing that you cannot do. And that Ugandan farmer is a great example. So how do we get that message across to people that don't feel constrained? What is your advice on that?
Yeah, I think the other part of that story is that some people will pivot further. They will have a vision for accomplishing one thing, and they will depart from the entire process they thought they might use to do it. I visited a maternity hospital in Nairobi.
Yes.
And they initially started out thinking that they were only going to do prenatal care.
Yeah.
Right? To help women get through, because Kenya has free community hospitals. And so if you're living in Nairobi, you have proximate access to a free place to go deliver your baby.
Yes.
But there was tremendous demand from the women who appreciated their prenatal care. They're saying, we want to deliver our baby here.
Yes.
Because you will take care of us better, and we will pay a little bit. We're not rich, but we'll pay a little bit for the privilege. And so they ended up with building a maternity hospital that competes with the free hospital, and their customers are all, I shouldn't say all, but mostly poor women.
Yes.
The poor women who say, I'm pregnant for 9 months. I can plan for this, and I will save up my pennies so that when it's time for me to deliver, I can give you $100, deliver my baby in this clean, safe hospital where I can stay for 48 hours and be treated like a human being instead of sharing a delivery bed, literally,
with
three other women who are delivering babies at the same time for free. And So they made a big shift. Their vision for helping women have healthy babies didn't change, but they realized they needed to take a different, broader, more expansive role in order to be successful.
But how do we bring that back? Because, I mean, Africa is obviously has its own entirely different set of circumstances to, you know, you sitting in Salt Lake City, I guess, and me sitting in, you know, Newport Beach, California. You know, we don't share the same set of challenges. But part
we really face a lot of the same challenges. And so there, one of the decisions that entrepreneurs need to make is, are we going to fix the process? Is what we're doing creating enough value in the value chain, and we just need to fix processes to allow us to do it more efficiently, better at a lower price, or deliver more value in some way along, or are we doing in some way the wrong thing and need to do something else or something in addition in order to be successful with our vision and mission?
Yes.
And I think that is a universal question for entrepreneurs.
It is, but also when entrepreneurs, when anybody starts out trying to start a business, they're relying very much on their experience and certain datum points that they have to give them a foundation to decide what to do. But do you feel some sort of, you know, tension or angst having seen all of these opportunities? Do you feel that there's an urgency to get a message out to people to say, focus on what is valuable from the outset? Don't chase this path and then end up in a cul-de-sac. I mean, is there something that you've learned that is there a message that you want to try and keep ramming home over and over again?
Well, you know, I think what I see is that the decision for social entrepreneurs often comes down to a key decision about how are you going to finance this? And it's really a tough question because for social entrepreneurs especially, it's a little different Because social entrepreneurs have the option oftentimes of setting up a nonprofit to do what they're doing.
Yeah.
And in that way, they can attract donations. Now, a for-profit business can attract, and some do attract, some donations.
Yes.
We don't often think of them as donations, but a lot of tech businesses go after grants of all different sorts, often government grants that are intended to spur technology development and commercialization. But in the social entrepreneurship world, it's often grant money from foundations, sometimes from government, often from individuals. But those decisions have long-term implications.
But the amount of money that's available from impact investors is huge. I mean, are people aware of the number of funds that are available to support?
Yeah, I think they're not. I think they're still trying to figure it out. A lot of funds are very specialized, so there's still a lot of gaps in the impact investing marketplace. If you're a social entrepreneur, you may be in a gap where it's more difficult to raise capital from impact investors, and it may be easier to raise it from donors, from foundations. It's interesting. There is in the social entrepreneurship movement an idea that relying on donations is not a sustainable business model. I hear that a lot. And yet, I look around and I see organizations like the Catholic Church, United Way, that have been around for millennia or centuries using an entire reliance on donations. And I say, I don't think that model is flawed. I don't think that is an unsustainable model.
Yeah.
What you have to be doing is you have to be creating value in the community in order to continue to attract those donations. You've got to do something that matters. You've got to do it well and successfully. So I love the idea of creating a for-profit business that can scale and solve a social issue. But I also continue to believe that nonprofits have a vital role in solving these problems as well. And as social entrepreneurs, you really have to identify at some point which path you want to be on. And some you can switch back and forth. I've seen that happen a lot too.
I think social media is actually pushing those two worlds together, because I think in order to be successful on social media, you have to be vulnerable, transparent. You can't wear a mask. You know, the corporate veil is pierced very quickly in social media. People can tell if you're fake.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering whether or not going forwards, I mean, you in one of your talks, you say that in 2045, which is, you know, 30 years from now, 28 years from now, the world will be a completely different place. And I'm just wondering, social media, I mean, you have thrown yourself into the deep end of social media in the last 5 to 6 years.
Yes.
I mean, do you find that is somehow pushing those two worlds together?
Yeah, yes, I do. And I think you're right. We have socialized people to the idea that we can and should do good, that companies should be responsible. And so we see, you know, the largest companies now are to the smallest, are trying to figure out ways to demonstrate that they are being responsible stewards of their of the business. And so that they're looking out for their employees, they're looking out for their customers, and they're looking out for their shareholders. They're looking out for the environment. There's a much more holistic approach to business at every scale.
Yeah.
And of course, some businesses, you know, you think of an Apple computer, are continuing to do what they've always done, essentially, except that now the world is saying, you can't use child labor to make your phones. We're not going to buy your phones if you don't have a quality supply chain where workers are treated well and safely, et cetera, et cetera. And so we're seeing, I think, some great progress in general. And of course, that then blurs the line between what, when do you become really a social enterprise as opposed to a traditional enterprise with corporate social responsibility mission? And then, you know, further on, when do you become a nonprofit? Those are all blurry lines.
I think the difference
in some ways, thank heaven. We should all be thinking about how to make the world a better place in as deep a way as we can.
You're right. But I think that what you're saying there, structurally, there's a difference between a profit-making company and a nonprofit. That's a tax structure more than anything.
Yeah. And that may oftentimes that is the only difference. And I'll give you a great example. You think about a little business that cans food for groceries, for the grocery stores, and maybe they're producing a gourmet food. You can easily conceive of that business as sort of an artisan food thing. You can easily envision that as a for-profit business.
Yes.
If you layer on one or two other things, though, suddenly it can become a nonprofit that can attract donations. If you are hiring primarily,
yeah.
I'm thinking of an actual company in Denver that does this. They hire women who have been homeless and in the criminal justice system.
Yes.
And these women have their lives completely messed up, and they get hired and they come to work making chili mixes and other things that are sold in grocery stores. Mm. And they get trained on how to go back to work. They start feeling like they have value in the community, and they deal with their addictions and they deal with their challenges. They get custody of their kids again, and they rebuild their lives, and then they can go on and get a better still job. But that provides a transition from a life of misery and addiction and homelessness to a life of productivity. And yet, once that's on a grocery store shelf, most people don't know or care.
But the people behind that company, did they know all of this from the outset, or was that a journey for them where they had this vision, they wanted to do something to help that particular group of people?
Yeah, it's my understanding that they started the business very much with the idea of helping that group of people, and they set it up as a nonprofit. And they knew that it would give them a context for providing real work experience. It wasn't, sort of fake work. It wasn't just training on how to get a job. We're going to put you to work and help you learn how to show up every day, how to deal with the challenges of a commute and all the things that happen in life that you need to deal with successfully in order to keep a job.
Yes.
So they conceived of it that way from the beginning, set it up as a nonprofit, and they recognized that that would raise their labor costs.
Yes.
And that they wouldn't actually be able to generate a profit from their products, at least not for a very long time. I think they still plan to get to a point where the product sales will be sufficient to fund their operations. But for now, and they always have operated with a donation model to supplement
Yes.
the worker training aspects of the business.
But I think the important thing to get across is that there are billions and billions of dollars available through impact funds, through grants, through other types of donations. It's a tax efficient way for a company to provide capital to these types of companies.
I live in the crowdfunding world where that's another avenue of capital for entrepreneurs. And I'm very excited about both regulation crowdfunding and Regulation A as a way of funding entrepreneurship. And traditional rewards-based crowdfunding is such an effective way. I mean, we've seen people, lots of people raising now. They've kind of figured out the model for doing that $500,000 raise. There are people who have that sort of nailed. They've got that dialed in, and they can just tell you
yes.
how to do it. And that's exciting to know that if you've got a decent product, there's now a way to really introduce that to the world.
What we were talking about before we started on the interview was this sort of concept, as it were, that many people have, that when you talk about entrepreneurs, you have this immediate vision of a tech startup in Silicon Valley that has massive funding from a tech startup fund. And people think that it's absolutely impossible for them to get funding. But there are routes. So we have crowdfunding, impact investing, and the businesses and the people that you've spoken to, in most cases, do they start small? Do they find that once they've made that leap, once they've got the shovel dirty, as it were, do you just have success story after success story?
Yeah, most of the people I have seen be successful started with that model. They got the shovel dirty and then realized, you know, typically that meant they were spending their own money, and maybe it was their own $500, maybe it was their own $5,000, but they got the shovel dirty and then they realized, oh, I'm going to need more money. And, you know, they've used every channel that you can imagine, from bake sales to federal grants to impact investment dollars. They use, you know, whatever concept of money you can think of, they've used it in order to scale the business. They just go wherever they can find money to allow them to continue doing their thing and scaling up their business. So, yeah.
But your message is, you know, there's money out there. So you don't have to go to banks. You don't have to go to traditional lenders. And there's a lot of money. There's not just trickles. Is that what you found?
Yeah. It's hard to find. I don't want to oversimplify it. And one of the things I love about crowdfunding is that it is one of the most readily guaranteed sources of money, at least at modest scale.
Yes.
Right. If you need $5,000 for the next step of your thing, you're almost guaranteed that if you work hard, I mean, if you really, you know, read my book, do everything it says and work hard, you can raise $5,000. I mean, it's almost guaranteed. If you really get strategic about it, you could probably raise 50 grand.
And that's in your book. And your book is Crowdfunding for Social Good.
Yeah.
That's.
And I really think that is an exciting nuance. Now, obviously, 5 grand, 50 grand doesn't take you very far, but it oftentimes is enough to help you get enough scale, enough progress, enough success that more readily, bigger sources of capital are now available to you.
It's that step.
Gain scale. And so there are more people in your network who can help you access the money. So it builds.
And so these crowdfunding sites are product sites like Kickstarter and Indiegogo. And then there's regulation crowdfunding, where you can raise up to $1 million from non-accredited investors, basically from people that want to support you. So that's great. And you explore that in your book, Crowdfunding for Social Good.
Yes.
So that'll be on the show notes. So there'll be a link there for people that want to buy that. Right. How do people find out more about you, Devin? There's just not enough time to sort of explore everything you're doing. But
so the easiest place to go is devinthorpe.com.
Which is, and again, I'll put that on the notes as well. And if there was one message you could give to an aspiring entrepreneur that's listening to this and feels the calling, what do you think that would be?
It's get the shovel dirty, right? You've got to start shoveling. There is nothing like getting to work on actually doing the thing. And I mean, you got to get out of the office, you got to put down the pen, you got to set the spreadsheet aside and go do something. Nothing is more important in creating a successful venture than that.
Well, that's wise words indeed. Devin, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on.
Well, thank you. It's been an honor, Matthew. I appreciate you having me. It's great to renew our association, and I really appreciate the opportunity to visit with you. You've got a great thing going here.
That's fabulous. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Hooked on Startups. I'm Matthew Sullivan. See you next week.